Welcome to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and this is a special broadcast coming to you from Scandinavia, the top of the European continent. Our website is redicecreations.com. Go there for much more radio news and information about our program. Sign up for membership and get full access to our archives. And today we have an important program for you. We are going to talk with MEP, that's Member of the European Parliament, Marta Andreasen. She used to be employed by the European Commission as chief accountant. She was suspended from her job by the Commission in May 2002 for what they called failure to show sufficient loyalty and respect. The reason for this was that she refused to sign off the 2001 European Commission accounts, mainly because of the fraud and the waste that she saw within the European Union. I think that she has definitely showed enough sufficient loyalty and respect to all the people that are trapped within the European Union by not going along with their fraud, waste and corruption. And she has helped as an insider to open up this subject to the public and making it known. She has written a book about her experiences. It's available through Amazon. It's called Brussels Laid Bare. And so this is what we'll be discussing here today with Marta. I also hope that we can get into some information about the upcoming Lisbon treaty vote in Ireland, October 2nd. Very important, and I urge anyone that is even remotely interested in themselves and their own freedom and who is within the Europe to go to Ireland sometime before this vote. Let them know what you think, show up, have your say, wave a placard and talk to the people before they go to have their say at the ballot boxes. As a matter of fact, show up as a representative from your country and have your say. Again, Ireland is not only voting for themselves in this referendum, but for 500 million people in Europe who have been denied a vote by their so-called democratically elected leaders. And I'm just shocked at how little mentioning we have of the Lisbon Treaty in the media. Okay, and I just want to mention one more thing here before we say hi to Marta. I'm going to go to Dublin October 1st, 2nd and 3rd, and we'll be covering the vote in our way. If you want to meet up with us there, drop us an email and we'll try to arrange something on that note. But anyway, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Marta. It's great to have you with us today.
It's great for me to talk to you.
So why don't you just give us a quick rundown of your story. Tell us about what happened to you. Tell us about how EU treated you, basically, and what you saw in terms of fraud, waste and corruption within the European Union.
Well, I was appointed chief accountant of the European Union back in 2002 after a recruitment process that took 8 months. And I had heard about the resignation of the Central Commission, and I had also heard the word being spread of the big reforms they were undergoing from a financial and administrative point of view. So I was quite proud to be able to cooperate in this reform. But when I got there, I saw that the situation was worse than I thought because they didn't have the proper systems, both lacking procedures and lacking the technology. So I started to put requests to make changes. Some of the changes which I thought were critical and could have been made immediately because the technology was there. And I started to face strong resistance to my proposals. But at the same time, I was being asked to sign for payments for which I could not guarantee that they were going to the right person for the right purpose. So I started to be very concerned about this and raised my voice up to the highest hierarchy, which is the College of Commissioners. And they simply at first didn't reply my letters, and then they just tried to sideline me and put me on a job where I wouldn't be able to question the finances or have access to the highest hierarchy. I didn't give up, so I went to the European Court of Auditors, who had been criticizing the accounts for years, and asked them for their support, and the Court of Auditors also turned it back. And then I went to the European Parliament, where supposedly we should have the people who are defending the interests of the taxpayers around Europe. And they also refused to hear me. with no real ground on for this refusal. So finally, you know, after a 2 years procedure, I was fired. I was judged by people in the commission, high directors, high-level directors who had been managing funds without control for years. So I was judged by them, and they found me guilty of disloyalty. Hmm. And, well, I wonder to whom I was disloyal, because yeah, I think I was pretty loyal to the European taxpayers.
Absolutely. And in the beginning of your book, you have a little paragraph that basically says the Court of Auditors, which is financed out of the EU budget, is supposed to guarantee the proper use of EU funds. It has been unable to do this for the last 14 years, and there are no external auditors. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, first of all, I say there are no external auditors because the European Court of Auditors is another institution of the European Union, and they are paid out of the same budget, which means they have no independence, really. It's not like a company, a private company, where they call any, you know, a well-known audit firm, which is totally independent to them to make the audit. This is not the case here in the European Union. The European Court of Auditors is another institution financed by the same budget. So frankly, there is no separation of power, so to speak.
Yes.
The same happens with the Parliament. I mean, there are what they call interinstitutional agreements that prevent the Parliament from hearing certain key officials from the Commission, because, you know, this has been pre-agreed that there would not be this type of exchange of information. Mm. And this is appalling, because the Parliament is there to sort of monitor and fiscalize what the Commission is doing with the funds of the European people. So that's why I say, you know, there is no independence, and obviously they all are financed by the same budget.
And maybe you can tell us then how a little bit about maybe how the money is being spent, or what was it primarily that you kind of reacted to when you started to this process, so to speak, of non-cooperation, of not signing the account?
Yeah. Well, basically, the problem that I had is that I couldn't be certain that the payment that was made and allocated to a certain budget line was really being used for this budget line and was really being paid to the right person. One of the problems that the budget has, you know, as a general background, is that funds are paid in advance. And there needs to be a very strict control in that you have to be able to come back to the beneficiaries to ask them for the papers, the document that proves that they have really run the project.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem that the Commission has is that they make the payments to big agencies, and then they don't request the documentation back to prove that the funds have been properly spent.
Yes.
So there is no real control if the money is being spent for the right purpose or for the right amount. And this is the worrying thing. And it's aggravated because they pay before they get the documents. If they would impose the rule that payments can only be made once the documents have been submitted, I think the situation would change quite radically. But nobody is prepared to make this change.
Hmm. You mentioned the College of Commissioners as well. I doubt that many people will be familiar with them. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what that group does, so to speak.
Well, the European Commission is the executive arm of the European Union and the regulatory arm of the European Union. And what this means is that, first of all, they are the ones who propose regulation. They propose it to the Parliament and to the Council. And so they have a huge staff dedicated to write these policies. And they are the executive arm because they are the people who made the payments out of the budget for these projects you know, that have been included in the budget to be concluded or, you know, finalized. So they have massive power. At the top of this European Commission, you have this College of Commissioners, which is made of today 27 commissioners, one from each member country. And they have different portfolios. So you have the commission in charge of economic affairs, of internal market, of external policies, of agriculture, of development, of budget. There are in total 34 directors general, 34 portfolios, let us say. So sometimes, you know, there is are commissioners in charge of more than one portfolio. Now, and this 27 commissioners make up this College of Commissioners, which is, in theory, the highest authority in the European Union. And obviously they have power. Now, under these commissioners, you have the directors general, which are high-level civil servants. And these people are, in my view and from my experience inside the commission, the ones who really hold the power. How do they hold the power? Well, they receive the funds from the member countries and they can use them in the way they wish. Now, if there was control, they would have to use them just for the purposes that are defined in the budget. But as there is no control, the money is sometimes used for other purposes. And my conclusion is that they pay the subsidies to the people who show allegiance. So basically what they are gaining through the use of the budget is for through their discretionary use of the budget, they are gaining power for themselves.
And are the commissioners voted in place, or how do they end up on that position?
Well, the commissioners, what happened is that they come and go every 5 years. So by the time they realize that something is not altogether right, they probably have spent 1 year in the job and have signed a lot of papers that they shouldn't have signed or have agreed to certain things that they shouldn't have agreed. So, they are sort of involved in the irregularities themselves and therefore will not really expose anything. They also tend to take little responsibility for what's going on in their specific portfolio. And to tell you the truth, there is no real code of conduct that ties them tightly to the portfolio, to the responsibility on it, on their portfolio. Just now, you know, I can tell you that there has been a study made by the Parliament of the code of conduct of the commissioners, which they have been delaying for months now without having a final discussion in the aim that this is not, there is no new code of conduct agreed before the nomination of a new commission, which is appalling.
So how is the, I guess that what you're saying here as well is that the money today is being spent on all kinds of projects that are dedicated to expanding the European Union, so to speak. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
And by the way, I wanted to check with you as well if you heard about the Galvin report.
No.
This is an audit that was taken place about of 160 EU Parliament members back in 2008. For those who want to read more about that, by the way, which is a really interesting report, I'm going to link this up on our website so people can take a look at it. But that's another thing that we can leave for now then, Marta. But in regards to this other frauds, the expenditures and so forth, is there something more you can say about that and what you see things are heading, so to speak, if this continues? Maybe you can even let us know who's taken over your role after you left as an accountant.
Well, you probably have heard or have read in my book that I was the first qualified accountant to be on the job. So my predecessors were different professions, but not accountants. One was a jurist and another one was an architect and whatever. And after I left, there was a succession of three chief accountants. So basically in 1 year in total, counting me and the one who stayed after, you know, for a longer time, there were five chief accountants of the European Union in 1 year, which is amazing.
Yes.
So my successor, again, was not an accountant. And then the successor of my successor was not an accountant. And then there was a third one who was a qualified accountant. And this person has been there now for 5 years and is now moving to become the Director General of Internal Audit. But this person has been somebody who has made his career inside the commission. So he's been there maybe 35 years or even 40 years with the commission. And I think that the commission, what they learned from my experience was that they would never hire anybody from the outside.
Yes.
Which creates two kinds of problems. One is that, you know, you don't bring any fresh air into the commission. You don't bring any fresh methodology. People who work in the commission have departed from the real world, so they really don't know how business works out of the European Union. Something that is also applicable to how they develop policies. People who have never had experience in certain areas develop policies to regulate those areas, which I find pretty incredible. Anyway, they don't bring fresh ideas and fresh technology. And at the same time, they have this permanent allegiance of the people who perform the job, because these people are afraid of losing a whole career.
Yes.
And a job paid in an amount that they couldn't get out of the European Union.
You're mentioning some of the technology. Are you referring to computer systems, infrastructure? Or what do you mean when you're talking about implementation of certain type of technology within the EU?
Well, fundamentally, it's the computer system.
Yeah.
I mean, when I joined the commission, I was shocked to find that the computer system was totally undeveloped and that it didn't interface properly. And I think that, you know, when you think about reform in the ages we are living, the first thing you need to think about is technology, because, you know, you could put as many principles and procedures as you wish, but if you don't have the technology to cope with these procedures, then there's no use on having these procedures.
Yes.
And they made an issue of certain procedures they were about to put in place, but I could see very clearly that they didn't have the technology. That the technology, the software developed was done internally by people who, again, have no experience of the outer world, were not accountants, were not IT people, professional IT people. So, you know, it was quite awkward, really. And I think they insist in doing this. Whereas I was aware when I joined that the European Union had requested a famous German software company to develop a solution for the European Union budget, to manage the budget and do the accounting. And that this had been paid and the licenses had been bought. But instead of using the whole product, they were just using the central model, the central accounting, whereas all the other modules that should have been used to introduce the transactions were left aside, unused, and another module and different modules created internally. So there were interface problems with this German software central module, and the others developed internally. This was one thing. So for a start, even in goodwill, the numbers, the input didn't match the output. And the second thing was that this interface not working and the different type of the of the systems made that people could manipulate those systems and put the figures they wanted. So, you know, pretty complex situation, yeah.
Very, very complex indeed. So what you're saying is that the system is bad for a reason, because frauds can kind of, I guess, go under the radar more easily then, correct?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Well, basically the system allows fraud to happen, allows manipulation. Worse than that, prevents you from detecting it and prevents you from having another trail so that you can go back and see who, you know, originated the irregular transaction.
Now, what do you think that this, if it is the case then that money is being put away somewhere, so to speak, where is the money going? Is it still funding EU projects, or is it going down into the pockets of some of the Euro elites, so to speak?
Well, it's a bit of what I told you a moment ago. I think the funds are used for the purpose of the European hierarchy acquiring more power. So they can decide if they give subsidies to this or the other farmer, depending on what allegiance is showed. And the same with, you know, structural funds.
Yes.
So it's difficult to, because there is no other traceability, it would be impossible to trace to what exact pocket the money went.
Yes.
But the general impression is that, you know, we are paying subsidies to the ones we decide are going to form part of a group, and refusing subsidies to those who will not, how would I say, support the European federal government, so
yes,
to speak.
Yes. Now, I don't know if you have any information about this, but what I've heard is that certain countries benefit greatly from being a part of the EU. I've heard Spain, Portugal, and many of the Eastern countries that have joined later in the EU, but countries, for instance, like the UK, Sweden, Denmark, Netherlands, and Germany are actually losing a lot and paying for this circus, as it were. Do you have any more information about this? Have you heard about this, Marta?
Well, yes. I mean, I have been involved in this, and yes, this is true. I mean, the biggest net contributor is Germany. The second biggest is the UK. And from there onwards, let us say that the northern countries in Europe are net contributors, and the southern parties, member countries, are mainly net recipients. Now, this is obviously changing radically because the eastern countries are coming in. And therefore, all the subsidies that were being paid, for example, to Spain or to Portugal or to Ireland, are now going to the eastern countries, in which case Spain, for example, is now facing a very difficult situation because together with the subsidies, the European Union is also favoring that the industries go to the eastern countries. So, for example, Spain or Ireland, you know, have started to lose their subsidies and will get no subsidies as from 2011. But at the same time, these countries are seeing their manufacturing facilities, industries, go to the eastern countries where the cost of labor is much lower.
Yeah.
So, you know, when the people say, well, Europe is going to take us out of the crisis, well, I don't quite see how the European Union is going to take us out of the crisis. I was last week campaigning for the no to Lisbon Treaty in Ireland, and I was telling these people that the European Union has brought no solution for the economic and financial crisis that Europe is going through, nor do they have any plan to do so. Things are getting worse because, obviously, having incorporated these eastern countries, the subsidies have to go to these people, and the industries are going to these people. And worse than that, you know, Ireland is a country that has developed its economy up until 2002 out of a very favorable corporate tax for companies to invest there. And once they ratify the Lisbon Treaty, they will not be independent to establish their own tax policy, which means they will have to abide by what the European Union decides, and therefore will not be able to give the companies this favorable corporate tax, and then will lose the investments.
Do you think that that is what is going to happen if indeed they get a yes vote over in Ireland?
Yes. I mean, what I know is that if they get a yes vote, the Lisbon Treaty is going to be ratified, and the Lisbon Treaty provides for a common tax policy, which I find impossible, really.
Yes.
Because the level of, I mean, the economies of the different countries have different levels of development. And now with the crisis, this is obviously making the differences worse. So, for example, if you have read the court decision in Germany, the court decision by which the German Supreme Court allows the German government to ratify the Lisbon Treaty, they have clearly said that they will not accept interference on tax issues and social and welfare issues. So the Germans are protecting themselves.
Yeah.
What happens with the other countries who are ratifying the treaty, such as Ireland?
Yes, yes. So what is this evidence for to you? I mean, to me, it sounds like this idea of distribution of wealth, basically, and to me, it sounds like a more socialistic-run government. Is that the political agenda here, or do you have something else to say about that?
In Germany or in the European Union?
In the European Union, like overall, they're trying to distribute the wealth across the different countries here, right? That has to be the only solution, I guess, if they want to have a common a tax reform, right?
Well, I don't see that they are going to distribute the wealth. They have opened the barriers for the Eastern countries and other countries. They are, obviously, these countries are getting the subsidies and are starting to develop. With some concern because some of them have quite corrupt governments. So we'll see in the end how the money is going to be used. It's not certain that it's going to be used properly. But it's not about now distributing wealth, you know. It's about coming up with a solution to the crisis. It's about developing the industries. It's about, you know, discussing globalization and to what extent globalization has to be in use or implemented in Europe. I mean, there are many difficult aspects to consider, but basically what I say is that the European Union is about a political elite who has been, you know, enjoying a nice life here in Brussels.
Yes.
And who aims at establishing a super state here and, you know, acquire more power for themselves and make the decisions for the different countries, regardless of if the decisions are meant to distribute welfare or not.
Yes.
Which I think is not the case. And I think we will see things happening soon because now, because of the crisis, the gaps between the countries have been becoming wider. And you know, they call this group of countries the pigs.
Yes.
Portugal, Italy, Ireland, and Greece and Spain.
Yes.
Well, let us see what's going to happen if these countries really cannot get out of the crisis. There's going to be a big gap in the budgetary stability, and therefore, you know, this will bring questions about the possibility or the viability of continuing with the euro with these countries and a number of things.
Yeah. Do you think that other countries then, like Germany, for instance, will take the blow for this? Or what you're saying is that they're getting out of this situation, so to speak. They don't want to pay for the pigs, so to speak.
Well, I mean, I'm not German, but my view is that the Germans have enough problems in their home. You know, the integration of the eastern part has not really been concluded. So they have a lot of problems at home.
Yes.
To be able to cope with problems outside of home. So I see pretty unlikely that they are going to come to rescue these countries. They might have a couple of years' patience, but in the end, if this is not resolved, they will not be able to save the countries.
Okay, well, I want to shift attention a little bit and ask you a little bit how you've been treated because of the way you've taken yourself out of position or a favor, I guess, with the Euro elite. How were you treated, and have there been any other critical voices within the EU that have supported you throughout this period?
Well, how was I treated can be summarized in two words: very bad.
Yes.
I was treated as if I was the fraudster, and they were the whistleblowers, more or less, or they were the people trying to keep the finances regular and legal. And, you know, it is quite appalling. It's appalling the arrogance with which they behaved. I mean, they don't even care to sort of try to show the world that they were treating me in a reasonable way. So I was first sidelined from my job as chief accountant, then I was suspended for 2 years, and then I was judged by a group of directors general and directors that all of them had been managing funds without control for years. A total conflict of interest, and they just couldn't care less. I was treated badly also by the parliament when I wanted them to hear me, and I was treated badly by the Court of Justice that even if I, you know, put a case with a lot of arguments, they just dismiss all my arguments. So I think it's awful. And I think they do this to deter other people from raising voices against what's going on inside. But this doesn't help the European project to move forward with integrity and transparency, really.
Now, you mentioned something in your talk that you did in Ireland recently about that if you have, I think it is around 1 million signatures, you have your right to get your voice heard within the European Parliament. But something has happened there. You did this, isn't that right? And it just didn't pan out. What happened there?
Well, yes. What I mentioned in Ireland was that they shouldn't believe this, what they call the Citizens' Initiative, that the treaty is promising, whereby if there is an issue about maladministration in the European Union, they can get 1 million signatures and ask the parliament to deal with the problem. Before, up to now, any citizen could put a petition to the parliament. There is a formal procedure which is called petition procedure, where you put a petition to be heard or to ask a certain matter or issue to be dealt with. And this is what I did when I was sidelined from my job. I went to the parliament and said, listen, I think the issues I have to raise are of serious concern for the European Union budget, and the parliament should deal with this.
Yes.
And they never allowed my petition to be heard. So what I was saying in Ireland is, you know, whatever they tell you, they will hear your petition if it is, if it can be comfortably dismissed as not being an issue. If it is a real issue, they will never hear whatever, if you get 1 million, 2 million, or 10 million signatures. So it's a right which I think it's absurd.
And, now, of course, you're back involved with the EU again as an MEP now, then via the UKIP, the UK Independent Party, and this must be a thorn in the side of the European Commission. Have you been treated badly afterwards again now, or how is your relationship with some of the people within the EU?
Well, I'm here working from mid-July, so it's very recent. But yes, I have already had the first signs of contempt.
Yes.
Towards me, because I am a member of the Budgetary Control Committee, and the Budgetary Control Committee has a president and vice president that when the parliament session starts need to be nominated, and they are basically nominated by this, the Hunt formula, which is the same formula used for the European elections to allocate the votes to the members in the list. And I was bound, according to the Hunt formula, I was bound to be the first vice president, which is a position that in theory gives you a lot of power within the committee. And they, the two main groups, the socialists and the PPE, decided secretly to vote me down. So they asked for a secret vote, and I was voted down. Now, the people think that this will deter me from doing what I need to do, which is not the case. To a certain extent, I think it's better, because being part of the managing committee of the budget, budgetary committee, would have forced me to operate in the consensus fashion that they usually use. And I want to be free to ask the questions and challenge the arguments one by one.
Yes.
So to a certain extent, for me, it's better. But anyway, this is showing how aggressive, what a lack of democracy there is, and what a lack of transparency there is in this institution that should be representing the people.
That's right. And so what do you ultimately think is the solution here? What do you see as the way out of this? Do you think that just a proper auditing system should be set up, and it should be proper, the EU should be properly democratically handled? Or do you think that the solution is for the individual countries to actually go out of the European Union and totally dissolve it? What do you see?
Well, after my story and my experience, which now, you know, takes 7 years, I have concluded that there is no way this European Union is going to reform. So I am of the opinion that the countries should start to get out and, you know, cause the whole project to collapse, and have the opportunity to renegotiate a different agreement amongst the different countries in Europe, which maybe will only have to be on a trade basis and may well be bilateral, if not, it cannot be, you know, amongst all the countries. But I think that there has to be, the only thing that will move the European Union to revise its whole structure and its transparency and democracy and accountability is that the countries who are the main contributors decide to get out.
Yes. I want to talk a little bit here about the Lisbon Treaty, of course, again here, and the vote in Ireland. You mentioned a little bit about the favorable current kind of corporate tax that they have in Ireland, but what do you see in regards to the Lisbon Treaty? Again, if they vote yes over there, how do you see that this will affect the Irish, and what would you say to them at this point, if you could say something to give them the proper information to actually give us a vote, a no vote here?
Well, I have mentioned a bit about the corporate tax. So one of the issues they need to consider, and you know, they are being made afraid by telling them that if they don't vote, ratify the Lisbon Treaty, the whole relationship with the European Union is going away, and nobody's going to help them out of the crisis, all of which is totally untrue. So the people need to understand they had an economy without the European Union's help. They can go back and have this economy. The fact that they don't ratify the Lisbon Treaty doesn't mean that, you know, the whole relationship is broken. I think life will go on and nothing will happen. And I also think that you know, they need to be aware that many countries are looking at Ireland for them, who are one of the few who have had the possibility to vote to say no.
Yes.
I think also the guarantees need to be discussed, because the guarantees, you know, first of all, have no legal basis. Even if the promoters of the yes are saying that this is going to be lodged with the United Nations, well, the Lisbon Treaty itself says that the supremacy is on the European Union Court of Justice. So what value lodging these things with the United Nations has, I don't have a clue. The Baroness Kinnock, who is the Minister for Europe for the UK, said, responding to concerns of the countries who, in theory, are not getting these guarantees, so the UK, for example, she said, well, this will not, these guarantees, you know, will not be incorporated into the treaty. The treaty will not change. So these guarantees, in best of cases, will be put into a protocol which will be added to the treaty when a new country comes into the European Union, which may never happen because the next one would be Croatia, and there's, you know, significant concern about what's going on in Bulgaria and Romania, and now, you know, the controls for Croatia are becoming pretty hectic, so to speak.
And there's talk about Turkey even eventually joining as well, right?
Yeah, well, but this would be after Croatia, I would think.
Okay. So I heard recently here, well, I can say Sweden, who currently holds the presidency for the European Union, and our prime minister up here, and the Bilderberg member, Fredrik Reinfeldt, said recently that if the Irish votes no to the Lisbon Treaty, they intend to move forward with the Nice Treaty. Do you know what this means, and what the consequence of that would be? I don't know too much about the Nice Treaty. I guess it's just a precursor to the Lisbon Treaty. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, what they say, I'm not an expert either, but I have more or less read this. And basically, the Nice Treaty gives voting rights, which are different from what the Lisbon Treaty gives. So it gives bigger voting weight to the people, the countries who have more population and higher GDP. So it's the countries who also contribute more to the European Union. And basically the theory is that the Lisbon Treaty is trying to resolve managing a group of 27 or more countries, which the Nice Treaty doesn't provide for. And therefore, it has to do a bit with the administration of the Union. And they say the Nice Treaty will not allow to handle 27 or more countries. So if they wouldn't ratify this, we will go on with this Nice Treaty. In practice, you know, the only change would be the voting weight, really. And this is what probably concerns the biggest contributors. They are the ones who are nervous because they, with the Lisbon Treaty, they are gaining voting power.
Yeah.
Whereas the small countries or the ones who have been recipients, they will be losing voting power, voting weight. And this is, for me, the key element here. The big countries are very nervous about getting this ratified because they want to correct a situation which they think is unfair. And at the same time, the small countries can see that with this Lisbon Treaty, they will see their voting rights reduced.
Yes. Do you think that they will continue to push the Lisbon Treaty on the Irish people? If there is a no now the second time, will they do a third, a fourth, a fifth, and so forth? I mean, this could go on and on forever, or will they in some way, do you think, try to circumvent the Irish vote? Can they do that?
I think they will. I mean, I think they will put pressure with certain economic benefits or whatever. They will find a way to really pressure the Irish people. The problem is that if they, I mean, when I spoke to the Irish people, I said this, you don't have to think that if you vote no, the pressure is going to go away.
No, that's right.
Pressure is going to increase. But
yes,
at the same time, they expose themselves quite strongly, you know.
Yes.
And if the Irish would vote no, and the people would, the people are already angry that the Irish are being asked to vote no, to vote again. And if they would see that they ask the Irish to vote a third time, and if they would see that to pressurize them, they try to sort of limit certain benefits they are getting from the European Union, or to impose sanctions, then the people would be very concerned in other countries.
Yes.
And they would, you know, it would be the undemocratic type of arrangement would be more exposed. And you have to remember that the French population and the Dutch population voted no to this constitution.
Yes.
Which is the same as the treaty.
Absolutely. So, they revamped it. And what they basically did, as I can see, was that they now they want to implement the same things, but through stealth this time. I mean, people like Giscard d'Estaing, Valerie, who wrote pretty much the constitution, one of the architects, as they call it, of the constitution, he's been apparently saying a number of times that we need to put it under the radar, so to speak. We need to bring it in without the vote of people, because generally consensus is that people don't want this in the European Union, but they're going ahead with it anyway, right?
Yes, because this is their style. This is what I tell the people also. Having worked inside, they are like a bulldozer, you know.
Yes.
They just go on, and they couldn't care less what the people say. That's the biggest problem of this European Union project. It has been developed, behind the scenes and against the will of the people. And I think that something like this cannot be long lasting, because at the end of the day, you know, the people will react one way or the other.
And I think that the longer or the more, as you say, if we get a second no vote in Ireland, and the longer this process takes, so to speak, I think that will be beneficial for those who do not want to be a part of the European Union. But in one way, I don't know how your view on this is, but to me, generally around me, I see people don't have any clue at all what's going on. They never even heard about the Lisbon Treaty. And the question is, of course, how do we get people interested? How can we kind of expose this? What's your take on that, Marta?
Well, I have worked a lot on this. You know, I have been to Ireland, and I, you know, obviously with my experience and my stand, I have exposed quite a lot. But
yes,
it is not always enough, and I have to come back to my prior experience and say that when I was not in the European Union, I just couldn't care less what was going on, because I was busy trying to raise my family, to do my job properly, and, you know, deal with my own personal and financial and economic situation.
Yes.
So, and this is the life that most of the people have, really.
Yes, yes.
So it's not that you have a lot of time to think about what's going on at the European Union level. But what people don't realize is that this European Union that they see so far is very near and is issuing 80% of the legislation that is regulating our lives.
Yes.
And this is something that people need to understand. You know, who is regulating my life? What is the nature of this animal regulating my life? What experience do they have? What trust can I put on them? What transparency do they show? How, you know, honest and what integrity they have. So, and this, I can fully understand the attitude of the people, because I was like them before.
Yes,
but
yes.
Now I have been inside, and I think it is my mission to, you know, publicize as much as possible what I went through inside, for people to understand, you know, what this is all about. Really.
Absolutely, and you're doing a great job at that. I mean, again, as you say, this is about centralizing power, and what I see is that more and more power is being moved further away from us, obviously. And someone commented in another book I read recently with a critical view on the European Union, is that if all the power is shifted over to the European Union, as they're dreaming of, so to speak, then eventually our national parliaments would have to be kind of put out of, they will have to be defunct in a way, because they won't serve a purpose anymore. Do you think that that is what eventually is going to happen, or are we going to have two layers of political institutions above our head? First, the national, who really doesn't have any power, and then at the end of that, the European, who ultimately wields the greater power at the end.
Well, in the near future, it looks as if we are going to have these two levels of government, and it's up to the people to sort of show reaction and refuse to accept this. And I think this will come. I don't know how long it will take. I said in Ireland, you know, and I've said in other places that many times when I go on an interview about the European Union finances and financial management, I get somebody on the other side who is Europhile and says, oh, you know, as the big argument is we already have corruption and fraud in our own government. And I always say, well, yes, but you don't need another level of corruption.
That's damn right. Exactly right.
I mean, it's such a silly argument that I can't believe they use this argument, because fine, if you have this level of corruption, you should do something about it.
Yes.
But at least refuse to accept another layer of corruption. And a lot of the corruption that happens in the European Union has to do with the fact that the member state, people in the member states, you know, ally with this and help them perform the corruption. So
yes.
This is not only the European Union itself, it's working with the member countries. But it's this, you know, corrupt structure that is causing the damage to Europe. So I think there is going to be a reaction, but it may take years. And the economic and financial situation could have an impact one way or the other, that is making people very afraid and therefore just making them stop questioning the European Union, or making people very brave and realizing that the European Union is not bringing the solution to this crisis, but it is making it worse.
Yes. Marta, if we begin to round things up here for this time, generally, are you positive, though, if we look into the intermediate future here and the vote in Ireland? The recent polls now show that support is going down for the Lisbon Treaty, and people are probably going to vote no. Do you think that's true, and do you think that we will indeed have a no a second time?
Well, because I'm fighting for this, I hope we will have a no.
Yes.
I have to be very, you know, confident that we will get the no.
Yes.
I think it's going to require a bit of work, because obviously the yes camp has a lot of money. They have funds to run a proper campaign, and the no camp doesn't have this money. We are trying to help, but and you know, we can do as much as we can do. But I think that sometimes the arguments, even if made in a small group of people or in a radio comment or whatever, can have big impact. I know that my visit has had a certain significant impact. And, you know, there are certain things that certain issues that you raise and the people in the street can understand very well.
Yes.
But such as, for example, the fact that Intel is given money, is given 300,000 euros to the Yes campaign. Well, Intel has a pending fine from the European Commission.
Yes.
I think it is a terrible conflict of interest that these people would, you know, decide to give this money on the eve of receiving a fine from the European Commission. And these are things that the, you know, the people in the street need to know. So it will require a lot of work.
Well, it will. And also, I mean, just to dovetail what you just mentioned about funding and so forth, I mean, I think EU spends, in a report late last year that was released, I think EU spends about £2.3 billion a year on propaganda, pretty much. Have you heard about that?
Yes.
So do you think that that's difficult to fight, or is that rather an evidence to show that they're scared and they're really trying to change how people think, because inherently people are against the European Union?
Well, to start with, let me tell you, it's a waste of money, because the programs they design, I mean, I had the opportunity to face this type of publicity when I was running for MEP for the United Kingdom Independence Party.
Yes.
And, you know, I met people who supposedly had to make a lot of advertising for the European Union, and they were very poor in arguments. So they probably put this money out, but it's a waste of time, because they don't really, they are not strong in their arguments. they are very poor. So sometimes I think it's better to let them speak.
Really? That's a good point.
It's the best publicity for the camp.
That's a very good one. You know, I think the only problem that I have at this point is that, you know, we are paying for it, so to speak, the taxpayers in the European Union. We are paying for all this crap, you know.
Yeah, I know. Don't tell me. We are all paying for this crap.
Yes.
But, you know, sometimes, you know, it has the other effect, that people looking and hearing them speak is how they realize, you know, this is awful.
Yes.
When I was in Ireland last week, at the same time as I was addressing certain public meetings, Pat Cox was addressing certain public meetings, and Pat Cox, as you may recall, was the president of the European Parliament some time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this person has really no message to give to the people. So, and I was told by people who attended both meetings, mine and his, that, you know, exactly what I said to you before, the best publicity we have is letting them go around and speak, because they really cannot make no solid arguments about this.
Well, to round things up here this time, Marta, the book is called Brussels Laid Bare. It's available through Amazon, that details this inside story that we've briefly been talking about here today. And I want to thank you very much for your time. Keep up the great work over there in Brussels, Marta.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening and for paying attention to this important topic. Help to spread the word as far and as wide as you can. And don't forget to further inform yourself about the EU by listening to our programs on the same topic of the corruption in the European Union and the Lisbon Treaty with MEP Nigel Farage, Simon Murphy and Paul Flynn from Truth Coalition Ireland, who just have been sending out copies of their paper, Sovereign Independent. We also had David Icke with us recently talking about this issue, and we have an upcoming program with Anthony and Derek from We Are Change Ireland. So check out our radio archive for much more on this topic. And again, I want to mention that we're going over to Dublin October 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And if you have the opportunity financially and time-wise, go over to Ireland sometime before the vote. Go to one of the bigger cities, Dublin, Cork, Dunleary, or Limerick, and let them know what you think. Show up, wave a placard, and talk to the people before they go to the ballot box. Okay, until next time, take good care. We'll talk later.